In 1998, there was this guy who didn't even go to film school, right?
Right. No formal film education at all.
And he had to shoot his very first movie on weekends, mostly just because he literally couldn't afford enough film stock for, like, a normal production schedule.
Yeah, he was paying for it entirely out of pocket.
Exactly. So because he couldn't afford to shoot a continuous linear story, he chopped the timeline into pieces to save money.
Yeah.
And now, you know, 25 years later, that highly specific budget constraint has somehow evolved into the defining architectural style of, well, the biggest blockbuster director on earth.
It's an incredible evolution, taking what was essentially a logistical nightmare and turning it into a completely signature artistic language.
It really is. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is decoding the cinematic machinery of Christopher Nolan.
Which is quite the undertaking.
Oh, absolutely. But we have a great map for this. We're pulling from a freshly published, incredibly comprehensive report. It just came out today, actually, July 11, 2026.
Hot off the presses.
Right. It's by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's titled The Cinema of Christopher Nolan: Time, Memory, Identity, Choice, and Consequence. So for you listening, if you have ever walked out of a Nolan film feeling that specific mix of, like, total awe and complete cognitive overload,
which I think most of us have at some point,
right, then this deep dive is specifically for you. We are going to break down exactly how he takes these massive abstract concepts, you know, relativity, memory, guilt, and somehow turns them into sweat-inducing suspense.
And to really understand how he pulls that off, we have to look at the central paradox of his career.
Yeah.
The report highlights that Nolan operates as a formal modernist, meaning he loves to fracture timelines, he presents alternate viewpoints, and he builds these highly experimental, self-conscious narratives.
But at the exact same time, he is this massive popular classicist.
Exactly. He demands old-fashioned photochemical film. He insists on total geographical clarity in his action scenes. And he's this incredibly staunch defender of the giant communal theatrical experience.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we get to the giant IMAX cameras and, you know, the exploding airplanes, we really need to look at where this all started.
Back to the beginning.
Right. And as I mentioned, it did not start with giant budgets. It started with really severe limitations. I think a lot of people just assume he has this heavy technical background in physics or engineering or something, just given how precise his movies are.
You would completely think so. But he actually studied English literature.
Right.
Yeah, at University College London. So he was spending his days deep in the humanities, analyzing unreliable narrators, parallel structures, mythology, things like that.
So no cameras at all during the day.
No. But then, on the side, he was picking up the actual technical nuts and bolts of filmmaking through the university's film society. So he was basically operating in this hybrid zone between classic literature and, like, do-it-yourself guerrilla filmmaking.
Which explains so much about how his brain works, honestly.
Oh, for sure.
What's fascinating here is that you see that exact synthesis in a 3-minute short film he made back in 1997. It was called Doodlebug.
Oh, Doodlebug. That premise is wild.
It's so weird. It's just a guy in a bare room desperately hunting this tiny bug with a shoe, but he finally corners it. And when he looks closer, he realizes that the bug is actually, like, a miniature version of himself.
Right.
And then, this is the kicker, he looks up and sees a giant version of himself holding a massive shoe about to squash him from above.
What's fascinating here is that it's this brilliant miniature conceptual laboratory.
Oh.
All the themes that are going to define his career scale, self-destruction, circular causality, being trapped in a recursive loop, they're all sitting right there in embryo.
Yeah, in just 3 minutes. But obviously, 3-minute shorts don't pay the rent.
No, they definitely do not. He was actually doing corporate video work to survive. And that's how he funded his feature debut, Following, completely out of pocket.
Right. Shooting on weekends with his friends, using borrowed locations, whatever available light they had, and shooting on 16mm black and white film.
Which is notoriously unforgiving.
And expensive. Film stock was so wildly expensive for a guy paying out of pocket that they had to be incredibly disciplined. It's almost like writing a novel where you're only allowed to use 100 specific words. The severe constraint forces you to be endlessly creative with the structure just to make the story function.
That limitation birthed his entire philosophy, honestly. He just didn't have the time or the budget to shoot a continuous linear descent into crime. So he shuffled the chronology.
Because he had to.
Right. And what that does to the audience is profound. You're no longer just sitting back and passively consuming a story. You are forced to actively read material details.
Like what?
Like you have to look at the main character's haircuts, or you have to notice if he has a fresh bruise on his face in this scene, or pay attention to what stolen objects are sitting in a cardboard box. Literally just to orient yourself in the timeline.
So you essentially have to become a detective. You're reading the evidence along with the characters. And, you know, once the massive Hollywood budgets finally did become available to him, he didn't abandon those structural tricks.
Not at all.
They evolved into his ultimate obsession, which is, of course, time. But I have to be honest here, and I know I'm not the only one who feels this way.
Here it comes.
Well, sometimes the time manipulation just feels like a gimmick. It feels like he's shuffling a deck of cards just to show us how smart he is. And it can leave the audience feeling, I don't know, a bit alienated.
That is a very common reaction, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the report argues that if we look closer at the mechanics, Nolan distinguishes between chronological time, you know, the measurable objective ticking of a clock.
Right, actual time.
Exactly. He distinguishes that from experience time, which fractures under trauma or expands under fear. He isn't scrambling timelines to trick you. He's using time as a pressure cooker to force morally compromised characters into irreversible choices.
Okay, that makes sense.
Take his breakout film, Memento.
Right. The guy with short-term memory loss trying to find his wife's killer. So in that one, the color scenes run backwards and the black and white scenes run forward. Which, again, kind of feels like a puzzle just for the sake of it, doesn't it?
It does on the surface. But it actually functions as what academics call an epistemological disability.
Okay, that is a mouthful.
It's a very fancy way of saying Nolan purposely breaks our ability to know what is true.
Got it.
Because the color scenes run in reverse order, each scene begins without you knowing what caused it.
Right, you're just dropped in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You experience the character's absolute conviction, his anger, his drive, without having any idea what generated those feelings a few minutes prior. You are trapped in his exact same mental deficit.
Oh, wow.
And when the timeline finally converges, and we realize he is intentionally burning evidence so he can keep hunting, the realization hits you that his entire identity is a routine he authored himself to avoid grief.
Man. So we aren't just watching his confusion, we are actively suffering from it with him. And if Memento is about losing the past, it makes complete sense that his next big evolution was manipulating the present moment, which he literally maps out as physical layers in Inception.
Yeah, Inception is wild. We've got multiple dream levels, and each one runs at a completely different speed.
Right, so a few seconds of falling in the top level translates to, like, minutes of fighting in the second level.
And months of survival in the deepest level. But what keeps it from becoming a chaotic mess is the mechanical connection between those layers. They are tied together by a shared musical pulse and synchronized physical actions, which he famously calls kicks.
Right, like the van falling.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. When the van hits the bridge barrier in the first level, gravity shifts in the hotel hallway in the second level. He spatializes time, turning abstract temporal theory into physical architecture that you can actually walk through.
And then he takes that layered time concept and applies it to actual history in Dunkirk. But instead of vertical dream levels, he's dealing with horizontal historical reality.
Yeah, that was a brilliant shift.
We had the soldiers on the mole waiting for a week, the civilian boat on the sea for a day, and the pilot in the air for just 1 hour.
The mechanism of Dunkirk is fascinating because the film intentionally refuses to give you an omniscient general's map to stabilize the geography or the timeline.
Keeps you in the dark.
Right. By aggressively cross-cutting between a one-week event, a one-day event, and a one-hour event, he creates this terrifying illusion that they're all unfolding at the exact same speed. He takes vastly different experiences of vulnerability and braids them into a single, accelerating climax of survival.
It just completely collapses the huge scale of history into subjective, tightening suspense.
Exactly.
Which brings us to Tenet, where he pushes it to the absolute breaking point. The concept here is bidirectional entropy. To break that down without needing, you know, a physics degree, it's essentially visualizing a river that is flowing in two opposite directions simultaneously.
That's a great way to describe it.
You have forward-moving characters and inverted backward-moving characters occupying the exact same action scene. Causality itself becomes this literal physical traffic jam. But here's where it gets really interesting. Because the ultimate expression of this time manipulation isn't an action movie, it's Interstellar.
Yes. Turning the cold mathematics of relativity into pure emotional devastation.
The time dilation in that film is just agonizing. Matthew McConaughey goes down to a planet near a black hole for what feels to him like, what, a couple of hours?
Barely any time at all.
But because of the immense gravity, time moves differently. He comes back up to his ship and has to sit in front of a screen watching decades of video messages from his children.
It's so heavy.
In 3 minutes of screen time, he watches them grow up, lose hope in him, and finally give up. He turned theoretical physics into absolute heartbreak.
And if we look at the report, synthesizing this, what Nolan is doing across all these films is repeatedly placing his protagonists in situations where their knowledge is fiercely local and limited, but the consequences of their actions are global.
Yeah.
The audience is trapped in that exact same uncertainty. They don't have the full picture when they make their choice, which is exactly what makes the fallout of that choice so incredibly tragic.
But I keep coming back to a practical question here. How do you actually make an audience accept a story where time is flowing backward or, you know, gravity is shifting based on a dream three layers up? If everything's a mind-bending puzzle, why doesn't the audience just check out emotionally?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Because he forces those wild concepts into extreme, tactile, physical reality. This is where the metaphysical meets the material.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Nolan's fundamental belief is that physical evidence gives speculative rules credibility. Our brains subconsciously know when we are looking at computer-generated pixels. The physics are always slightly off, the weight just isn't there. Nolan knows that to make you buy the illusion, the weight has to be undeniable.
So when he needs an 18-wheeler to flip end over end in The Dark Knight, he doesn't hire a VFX house. He actually figures out the logistics of flipping a full-size multi-ton truck in the middle of a street in downtown Chicago.
Exactly. And when he needs a massive passenger plane to crash into an airport hangar in Tenet, his production team realizes it's actually more cost-effective and psychologically more impactful for the audience to just buy a decommissioned 747 and drive it into a real building.
Which is insane. Even in Oppenheimer, I mean, you'd think a movie about the atomic bomb would be a blank check for CGI explosions.
You'd think so, definitely.
But rather than relying on digital fireballs to represent the Trinity test or the terrifying quantum physics happening inside Oppenheimer's mind, he and his team spent months photographing practical, physical micro experiments.
Yeah, smashing ping pong balls, spinning luminous paint, dropping magnesium into water.
He grounds the most destructive force in human history in tangible physical elements.
And this commitment to physical reality extends directly to his use of IMAX cameras, too.
Right, the cameras themselves.
These are massive, heavy, incredibly loud machines that were originally designed to shoot sprawling documentaries about the Grand Canyon or, like, outer space. But Nolan uses them to shoot an intimate close-up of Cillian Murphy's face.
Which is such a weird choice when you think about it.
It is. But he turns a tiny, subtle micro-expression of guilt into a monumental architectural event that towers over the audience. For Oppenheimer, Kodak literally had to invent a brand new black and white 65mm IMAX film stock, and the crew had to re-engineer the cameras just to be able to run it.
Which begs the question, why go through all that trouble just for black and white?
Because he needed the subjective bureaucratic security hearing, which takes place in this tiny claustrophobic little room, to feel just as visually massive and oppressive as the atomic bomb itself.
Wow.
And that physical oppression doesn't stop with the visuals either. His auditory design is built on the exact same philosophy of overwhelming the senses.
Okay, let's talk about the sound, because the score is just as structural as the editing. The report heavily emphasizes his use of the shepherd tone.
Yes, a classic Nolan technique.
For those who aren't familiar, it's an auditory illusion where a sound seems to be constantly rising in pitch, getting higher and higher without ever actually peaking.
It works by layering separate tones separated by octaves. As the highest pitch fades out, the middle pitch remains steady, and a new low pitch fades in.
It tricks your brain.
Exactly. Your brain links them together, creating the terrifying sensation of endless escalating tension.
It is so nerve-wracking, and he pairs that illusion with massive low-frequency bass that you literally feel vibrating in your chest cavity in the theater.
Oh, absolutely.
In Interstellar, they recorded a colossal pipe organ using the sheer physical air being pumped through those massive wooden pipes to make a spaceship docking sequence feel, like, religious and sublime.
And in Dunkirk, the roar of the aircraft engines occupies the acoustic space in your own body before the planes even appear on screen.
Right. And in Oppenheimer, the composer Ludwig Göransson uses the rhythmic sound of feet stomping on a wooden gymnasium floor to create this terrifying physical manifestation of political judgment and atomic dread.
It's brilliant.
It is. Okay, but I have to push back here for a second because this brings up the most notorious critique of Nolan's filmmaking.
The sound mixing.
Yes. If he goes to such incredible length to invent new film stocks and construct these meticulously complex puzzle plots, why does he deliberately muffle the dialogue?
It drives people crazy.
It really does. He buries critical exposition under loud engines, or he puts literal physical masks on his characters, or he blasts the bass so hard you can't hear a word. Isn't that just bad mixing that alienates the audience?
It is definitely the most common complaint about his work, and it's a completely understandable frustration. But the report argues that Nolan fundamentally prioritizes environmental perspective over clean, isolated dialogue.
Meaning what?
He views the human voice as just another sound effect in the mix. If the characters are on a beach, straining to hear each other over a roaring dive bomber and the chaos of artillery, he wants you to strain and struggle exactly as they are. He absolutely refuses to artificially lower the background noise just so you can hear the exposition clearly.
So he wants the struggle to be part of the immersion.
Yes.
Even if it means you miss a plot point, you are feeling the reality of the space. It's a feature, not a bug, regardless of how much it frustrates us.
Exactly.
But looking at the entirety of this, you know, Nolan machine, it is awe-inspiring, but it definitely has blind spots. The report dives into some legitimate critiques of his work, particularly regarding how he handles his characters and the politically charged themes he explores.
Right. And the most persistent criticism regarding his narrative structures is the handling of female characters.
Yeah, that comes up a lot.
The argument is that women in his films are frequently reduced to dead wives, lost lovers, or static moral correctives whose sole purpose is to motivate the male protagonists.
They exist primarily as absences. I mean, you think of Mal in Inception, who is quite literally a projection of Cobb's guilt. Or the tragic foundational deaths of the wives in The Prestige and Memento.
The report does acknowledge an evolution in his later films, though.
Right, it's not totally static.
No. Characters like Murph in Interstellar and Kitty in Oppenheimer possess significantly more agency and causal force. Kitty, in particular, actively criticizes her husband's passive appetite for political martyrdom. She really challenges him.
She does.
But even with that progression, the cinematic universes he builds remain overwhelmingly centered on men dealing with their systems, their heroism, and their obsessive pursuits.
And the fact that his characters are so often trapped inside rigid systems brings up a larger question about how Nolan views systems of power in general.
Which is a huge theme for him.
Exactly. And looking at this report, and you know, for you listening, it's very important to note that our goal here isn't to take a partisan stance.
Oh, absolutely not. We're totally impartial here.
Right. And honestly, neither is Nolan in his films. The goal is rather to examine how he illustrates the mechanics of power. If you look at the Dark Knight trilogy, he's wrestling heavily with terrorism, mass surveillance, and class revolution. You have Bane utilizing this populist rhetoric to incite a siege on the wealthy establishment.
Right. Then in Oppenheimer, the focus shifts to McCarthyism, the crushing weight of bureaucracy, and the staggering ethics of weaponizing quantum physics.
Yeah.
What Nolan consistently illustrates, again, impartially, is how institutions utilize administrative paperwork, procedural rules, and mass panic to translate private vendettas into legitimate power.
The security hearing in Oppenheimer isn't a neutral, democratic pursuit of truth. It's a bureaucratic mechanism weaponized by Louis Strauss to inflict political punishment.
Exactly the same way fear becomes an industrialized resource in Gotham City. The films map the architecture of power without prescribing a neat, comforting partisan solution. He just shows us the machinery of the institution.
So what does this all mean? When you look at how he operates within the current Hollywood ecosystem, I honestly see Nolan like this stubborn master architect.
That's a good analogy.
He is aggressively insisting on building these massive tactile structures with physical masonry and huge communal gathering spaces, all in a modern era that is increasingly obsessed with cheap, 3D printed, isolated smart homes. He is fiercely defending the theatrical window over streaming platforms.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Nolan's unprecedented Final Cut power, his ability to dictate runtimes, command massive budgets, mandate analog film formats, and guarantee exclusive theatrical releases,
yeah.
That isn't a prize handed out simply for being an artist.
No, Hollywood doesn't work like that.
It's purely earned institutional capital. He has consistently taken wholly original cerebral concepts and made them perform at the box office like massive pre-existing intellectual property blockbusters.
Which is almost impossible to do now.
Exactly. And through his process, he argues that society actually loses something vital when cinema devolves into personalized content consumed alone on a phone.
Which brings us perfectly to his next highly anticipated film, The Odyssey, scheduled for wide release on July 17, 2026. True to his philosophy, it is being marketed as shot entirely with IMAX film cameras.
I cannot wait for that.
He's taking an ancient foundational myth and giving it the biggest, most tactile, physical canvas possible.
It really represents the complete realization of his directorial ethos. He is taking the ultimate journey of Western literature and filtering it through the most advanced, physically demanding photochemical technology available. He is ensuring that the scale of the myth is matched by the scale of the medium.
It's been an incredible journey to trace today. We started with the guy in 1998 chopping up a micro-budget black-and-white movie on weekends because he couldn't afford film stock, using limitation as his greatest weapon.
Right.
And we followed that evolution all the way to the sweeping, time-bending, large-format spectacles of Oppenheimer and the upcoming The Odyssey.
And throughout all of that technical and financial growth, the constant element is that Nolan treats you, the listener, as active temporal participant. He absolutely refuses to treat you as a passive consumer.
He makes you work for it.
He makes you work for the narrative. He makes you feel the crushing weight of time. And he constantly forces you to question the reality sitting right in front of you.
He takes that cinematic blender we talked about at the very beginning and shows you the exact gears turning inside it. Which I think leaves me with one final thought for you to chew on today.
Let's hear it.
Building on this core theme of memory and self-deception that we see in Memento and Inception, Nolan's characters are constantly authoring their own identities. They deliberately leave themselves clues or they project their guilt onto their surroundings just to survive the trauma of their past. So ask yourself, what selective evidence are you curating in your own life to justify the story you tell about yourself?